Good evening. Bonsoir, is it that late? Yes, okay. Welcome to, I have a whole list of things I have to say before we get properly started. And I've got them being an organized person right here. I'm sorry.
Yeah, just swing it around. And tip it up.
You're the expert. You've done this before.
I've done this before.
How's that? Is that better? Okay. And you've already done a sound check.
Well, I did that for you, but I swung it around and tipped it up.
Can everybody hear Eleanor? Okay. Good. Okay. Much better. Okay, so where's the sheet? This is sponsored by CBC Radio-Canada. And I think I lost the sheet. Well, so much for that. I think you already know our guest of honor, Eleanor Wachtel. Yes. We're here to talk about her new book, More Writers and Company, which Eleanor...
I just saw it 20 minutes ago.
Yeah.
It glows in the dark. Authors' royalties go to Pen Canada.
So you can buy it at the bookstore?
Upstairs.
10% off?
10% off just today.
Yeah, so hurry.
Don't you think I missed my calling?
You could do like a home shopping network, right?
Leon's Furniture.
You remember that. Okay. I'm supposed to point out the Penn Writer's Chair, which is, which is in honor of all the writers in the world who don't have it as easy as we have it in Canada or in North America. And that's actually a good transition to talking about your book, because I was reading the interview with Edwige Dantica. She's a Haitian-American writer, and you were asking her about when she first knew she was a writer, and she said that when she was a child, when she first started telling people that she was a writer, their immediate response was to tell her about all the writers who'd been thrown in jail or exiled or killed.
Yeah, her mother didn't want her to be a writer because it was too dangerous.
Yeah, and she said, it was a very striking thing that she said, it wasn't the best career choice, you know. So it takes us into a whole different reality from the one we know. But let's get to the book. You have to buy it, because I've been immersed in it for the last 3 weeks, and it's just an extraordinary book. I mean, it is so rich, it seems like, and maybe this is an illusion of editing, but it seems you have an immediate complicity with whoever you talk to, and they reveal things that, you know, I don't think they would reveal otherwise. And so my goal tonight is to find out how you do that. How do you do that?
By reading their books. I really think that a lot of it is that book authors, especially those who are on a promotion circuit. Excuse my back, I can't swing around there. Authors, especially when they're on a promotional tour, are often interviewed by people and who haven't had the opportunity to read their books,
right.
To read their work, and certainly not to read their backlist, which often I'm able to do. I mean, I really have the luxury of an hour-long interview in most cases, and the opportunity, because it's a weekly show, to read the whole book. I mean, when people are, I don't fault the journalists because if they're hosting a daily show or if it's for a newspaper or whatever, you know, the exigencies on their work, they're not able to, and that's why so much nowadays you'll see, like for instance, I will name in the Globe and Mail this Q&A, which is almost like the Proust questionnaire, you know, like what's the book beside your bedside table? What's this?
Your favorite
it's so
color.
Completely generic questions because. They not only haven't had time to read their book, they're not even going to pretend that they read the book. So it's really just a kind of a form of promotion and fills the space in the paper.
Because someone told me yesterday that he had heard you interviewing a Turkish writer whose name I didn't recognize, and at some point you revealed that you'd read all 15 of his books. And
I don't think so.
Maybe you fudged a little. Maybe this was a slightly exaggerated
I think it's
story.
A little hyperbolic.
But how absolutely delighted he was. It's also worth noting, I think, that in addition to all you have more honorary degrees than anybody I know, but I'm not going to list them. But the number of writers who have said amazing things about you is quite extensive, from Kazuo Ishiguro, who says you're one of the great interviewers, to George Saunders, to Deborah Eisenberg, to Julian Barnes. So those are pretty good recommendations, I think. Can you remember what the worst you get? I mean, you don't like being interviewed.
Not a whole lot, but I know this is a great opportunity, and so far it's going extremely
it's okay.
well, I think.
You've already sold some books, so we're ahead of the game. What's the worst question you've ever gotten as when you're being interviewed rather than as an interviewer, obviously?
Oh. I haven't been interviewed that many times. I've been interviewed with other books. I've published other books, and that's usually when I have been interviewed in the past. So I haven't been interviewed that often. I was interviewed very recently by someone who said, "So, 25 years seems like an awfully long time." I said, "What are you getting at?"
That's a bit daunting at the beginning of an interview.
So the implication, and he alluded to, it's like maybe or maybe not, you received other offers along the way or something. Anyway, that's...
That was it.
It was okay. I didn't mind, and I have a kind of standard riposte to that, which happens to be true, which is that the work keeps changing because the authors I interview because their work keeps changing. So the content of the interview for me, it's a different experience. Whether it's a new author or something, I always try to have a mix of people I've never spoken to before and other people whose career I followed. So the work is different. It's the whole worldview I'm experiencing in being immersed in their work is different. And then, especially when I get an opportunity to do these international series, then it's really a different world, because these are almost entirely, I'm talking to writers that aren't that well known outside their country, and many of them I hadn't heard of before.
Is that like your German series that's going on right now?
It's going on right now, and the writer who's on this Sunday, Reinhard Kleist, is a comic book artist who I'd never heard of, and he's just terrific. And I mean, I think his work artistically is terrific, and he's just a lovely person to talk to. So that kind of experience, I mean, just is exhilarating for me. So could be my 25th year of talking to somebody about something, but it's always something new.
Not just rotation, new ones.
No.
Yeah. In fact, today is the interview, the broadcast date of the interview that you did with Margareta von Trotta, the German
that
filmmaker.
That was last Sunday.
That was last Sunday. Okay, it said on the site that it was today. I don't know why.
It's probably still on the site because they changed the site on Saturday at midnight.
Okay.
So it would be the most recent. But it's available on podcast or on the website, so maybe that's why it's still there.
I have to say that, I mean... I've been interviewed by Eleanor once, not for the show, but for an event at TIFF in Toronto, and I had never seen anybody so well prepared. That, as I recall, you had a spiral notebook about this big, and it had color coded tabs.
Was
that for somebody else?
No. No, this is a series that I do at TIFF, is the Toronto International Film Festival, but it's also the name of the Cinematheque in Toronto. And I do a series for them in the spring called Books on Film, and it's about adaptation. And I do events where I talk about a book and a movie. A book that's been adapted, that's been made into a movie. And in this case, Will had written an entire book about this adaptation. And so the book that you're referring to was your book that you had written. And I always stick different color Post-its
Okay.
So it wasn't a spiral.
It wasn't a spiral
separate notebook. I would have had pages like you have there with questions and
stuff.
Yeah,
you did have on top of that.
That's right.
On top of that, you had
on top of that.
But a legal
I would have
pad,
had yeah,
and it looked very full
lot
of questions.
Yeah.
And then there was a type.
Yeah, but then but your book would have had all the different color. But there are different color tabs, but the different colors, it's not color coded. I mean, authors have asked me that, like all the yellow tabs refer to certain outdoor scenes or something.
That was my thought. Yeah, yeah. So it's just random.
They're just what I have a whole bunch of them, and I just stick them in. It's like in the olden days, I would make notes, but now I just sort of stick in tabs, and then I go back afterwards and see what I wanted to. It's because I still respect the printed page. I can't bring myself to use a highlighter or turn down corners. So the tab has been the sticky note and the tab. So I use that instead. But the sticky notes are all yellow, but the tabs are different colors. But it has no.
But it is a system.
Well, there's a system overall, but not by color.
Yeah. I'm glad we clarified that. In terms of, I was saying about the complicité that you seem to have with everybody, but the one interview in the new book that stands out, I think, is with J.M. Coetzee, the formerly South African and now Australian writer. And it's the shortest, well, there are two interviews, but the first interview is the shortest in the book. I think it's 4 pages long?
Might be a little bit longer than that. It was, first of all, it was done during the first season of Writers and Company. And in the first season, many of the programs consisted of two writers and sometimes even two writers and a literary feature. So we weren't necessarily aiming for a whole hour-long interview with a single author. That the first one of those was with Nadine Gordimer, also the first season, but that was a rarity at the time. So it would have been like what we could, a half show or a third of a show in any case, and it would translate into print as a short interview. But it was weird as well. You want me to say why it was so weird? Well, he came into the studio, and we sat down, and he pulled out what looked like an appointment book with these with a pencil in the spine and these little sort of tissue, very thin pages, and turned the pages. And I thought he was checking his diary to see what my name was, or something like that. But then he said, "Do you mind if I write down the question?"
As you asked it.
As I asked it. So luckily, it wasn't live radio, so it wasn't a problem. So I said, "Oh, it's fine." And so I'd ask a question. He'd write it down. And then he would or wouldn't make eye contact. And then he would answer the question. And then I'd ask the next question. And there would be silence as he wrote the question down. And then he would answer the question. And he would sort of take apart the question a little bit, but he wasn't being especially truculent or difficult about it. But he looked at the question as he was answering it. And we did this back and forth for a little while, question, silence, answer, question, silence, answer. And then he said, in a voice like this, I've lost my voice. So I said, it's okay, have some water. And I waited, and he drank some water, and then we continued and finished the interview. And at the end of the interview, he sat there, and he was just chatting and relaxed. And
really?
I could barely get him out of the studio. I mean, like, he was it was fine. And then he left. And then he did two interviews during that time. He was in Toronto for the Authors International Festival of Authors with a terrific book called Age of Iron. It was really, really good. Yeah. And I learned afterwards that he agreed to do two interviews, one with the Globe and Mail and one with CBC, i.e. me. And he did the same thing with the interviewer from the Globe and Mail in terms of writing down the questions, because the person, I thought it was just for radio or something, he wanted to carefully prepare himself, but he wrote down the questions for the before answering the Globe and Mail journalist either, also. And then years pass, calendar pages turn, autumn leaves on
just
the ground.
Like in the movies,
And it's now the year 2000. This was in 1991. So the year 2000, I was doing a special series on South Africa. And he had just won the Booker Prize for the second time for a book called Disgrace, which was so much, such a powerful novel. And I was going to Cape Town, and I just felt I had to talk to him. I was talking to other writers, as I mentioned earlier, who weren't well known outside the country, but I really felt this time I had to talk to him. But he hates interviews. He didn't even go to London to get the Booker. He didn't agree to any interviews. But my producer wrote to him, and he said he really didn't want to do interviews, but he would consider it because he had such a good time last. He remembered it so fondly.
And in the second one, he parses every word you use.
Well, in the second one, he asked to see the... He said... he said, I won't talk about myself, the country, or my work. And I want to see the questions ahead of time.
Right.
And so I'm very tenacious, and so I thought, like, trying to figure out how to get at this. And we sent in some questions, and he sent it back, and he said, I don't think this is going to work. I guess my producer prepared these questions, Sandra Rabinovich. I do all the special series with her. And she prepared these questions, and I guess it was just a little bit too close to some of these three areas of his self, his life, and himself, his work in South Africa. And so I'd read some work that he'd done of criticism. So I thought, well, we'll send in questions about his criticism. He'd written about Beckett and Dostoevsky and some other works. So he agreed to the interview, and he would also, he's a lovely reader of his work, and he agreed to read from Disgrace. And so I went to see him at his office in the University of Cape Town, and he was kind enough, when I asked the questions, to say, oh, what an interesting question, as if he'd never seen it before. And he was quite responsive, and I cheated a bit because I did do a few like follow-up questions, a little impromptu, like if he said something, I thought of some little follow-up to that. So that longer interview is in there, and I remember Michael Ondaatje for some reason loved that interview.
Well, it's a really interesting interview.
Well, I think it's because it's not about anything you expect it to be.
Yes.
About.
Well, you have a discussion about Dostoevsky in the middle of the interview.
Yeah.
And he said a really remarkable thing. It's simply not good enough to look in your heart and write, which is what they always tell you in creative writing classes. What comes out when you write is quite likely to be some self-serving lie, as it is to be the ruthless truth about yourself. The heart of our own desire is unknown to us. What is self-delusional is to imagine that you can tell the truth about yourself.
That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, especially from him, because in his more autobiographical fiction, it seems the unvarnished truth. I mean, it's so, he puts himself...
He's merciless.
Somebody,
he's really unforgiving.
He puts himself out in a very naked way.
And I felt that when he talked about Beckett, that he talked about, he said people think of him as humorless, but really he's quite funny. So I felt he was also talking about himself a little bit.
I once sat across from him at dinner two nights running, and I mean, he was right there, and I would try to make polite conversation, and he wouldn't say anything. Stared at me.
No, when I interviewed him in Cape Town, I met with a friend of his, somebody I knew, a poet, and she said that people come to her and say, "Don't put me next to him at a dinner party."
It was because he just lets you hang yourself, right?
Don't say anything.
You're just kind of dancing around, and being charming, and say, "I love Disgrace, and it changed my life," and he's like. And I gather Mavis Gallant wasn't the easiest interview. You describe it as duck and cover.
Yes. Question duck and cover. Well, but it was very, very different. And the last time that I interviewed Mavis Gallant, she actually was extremely forthcoming. And the first time she was much more querulous, I guess you'd say. But then she would still answer. You just had to justify. Did I say that, or where did you get? And if you told her what it was, then she would continue. But the most recent interview, which was done in Paris, she was working on her journals, and I think she was just in a much more open frame of mind. And I was barely finishing the question, and she was starting to answer. So it was a bit different.
Because there's that one point in the interview in the book where you ask her why her mother didn't tell her that that her father had died, I guess for years and years.
Yeah.
And she turns to you and she says, look, he's dead, R.I.P. And that really caught the spirit of Mavis Gallant and her books, I think, yeah. as well, that kind of tough, I guess, well, implacable.
Well, yeah, when I asked about that period of time, she would just say, they're all dead, I can't ask them anymore. I can't ask those questions. Like, you know, they're all dead in terms of their mother, her father, the aunts, the various people who knew what happened. I mean, it was a terrible story. Her yeah. father, her parents split up, basically. Her father went back to England. She was just told her father went on a trip. She was waiting for him to come back or to send for her. And he died while he was in England. And yeah. for 3 years,
yeah.
she didn't know. And it was only by accident. One of her aunts said, oh, something about, you know, don't you know, or didn't realize her.
This has bothered me ever since I wrote it. When she died, the Globe and Mail's obituary said that she had spent her last years in poverty. And I was just so stunned that that could happen to somebody of her stature and of her brilliance. How did...
I had heard that as well. And some of her friends, like Michael Ondaatje, would try to help her out. She lived in Paris for about 50 years. She didn't buy an apartment. She, at a certain point, I mean, she wrote for The New Yorker and she sold more than 100 stories to them, but at a certain point, she stopped writing stories and fiction. She was working on her journals, and probably if she were, I don't know, more mercenary or something, would have had some of those journals published, because yeah. she could have gotten money for that, but she was such a perfectionist in terms of her writing that she was waiting and working, and, you know, it was a long process. And every year, I mean, for several years now, these books are supposed to be forthcoming, these journals, and I hope
yeah,
they do actually
they
happen.
They seem to be taking their time.
But she was working on it with her New York agent. So I did hear that she was hard up, yeah.
It's incredible to me yeah. that could happen to her. Do you ever think, since the format of your show is a 50-minute interview, do you see parallels between it and psychoanalysis?
My producer used to accuse me of being a shrink monkey.
Yeah.
Because I was always asking people about their parents and their childhood.
Because I've read many interviews with Doris Lessing, and she came across always as so formidable and unreachable and, you know, spouting things from a great height. And yours, she sounds like she's stretched out on the sofa. And she's going over things from her childhood, yeah. quite intimate things that she's clearly been thinking about since her childhood.
Well, two things, this is real behind the scenes, two things helped me with that Doris Lessing interview. One, because I had interviewed her once before where she was much tougher to talk to. When she was in Toronto, it was a shorter interview, again in the earlier days, a shorter form interview. But this was later, and I went to her house in London. And so two things helped me. One was Margaret Drabble and Michael Holroyd were good friends of hers. And I actually asked Margaret Drabble to put in a good word. And I was lucky that I did, because the day of that interview, I was in London. I think it was something like July 23rd. I remember it because it was the day that Carol Shields died. And I found out about it, that Carol had died, just as I was heading out to do the interview. So if she'd been mean to me, I'm almost choking up now, I just would have melted. So I was very lucky that I had asked Margaret Drabble to put in a good word. So she was nicer to me. And the second thing, which was completely unpredictable, I could never have known and would never have imagined, was she had a cat that came over and sort of nuzzled in my lap. And she said, she never does that. She must like you.
Instant trust.
So I think that was it.
Yeah, because I was so stunned in the interview when she went on and on about how much she loved the 60s. And I thought she would have been, you know, sort of sneering at the 60s and the freedom of it and everything, but it was like, it sounds like the 60s happened in her living room, because she invited all kinds of young people to stay with her at all different times and
yeah.
extended periods of time. And there's, I don't know if you know Jenny Diskey.
Yeah, Jenny Diskey's been writing in the London Review of Books.
Yeah,
she was one of the people that Doris Lessing took in.
Yeah, and her point of view is a kind of score settling with Lessing that shows the side of Lessing that I thought I knew, but the side that you show is quite extraordinary. It's really, but I think it's in some way it's not getting the full power of your interviews to just talk about the book or even to just talk about the author, because frequently it's I mean, obviously it is the author and what he thinks or she thinks and on and on, but frequently it's just a whole world that comes with that writer. This again, mm-hmm. Do you mind if I talk about interviews that aren't in the book?
Sure.
I'm not going to buy it anyway. No. But I heard your Marlon James interview,
right.
And he wrote A Brief History of
Seven Killings, and which isn't brief, and is about more than seven
brief.
Killings, and it's not a history.
It's not a history either, and he's the first Jamaican to win the Booker.
Right.
But in your interview, we get just Jamaican history from colonial times to the present. We get a history of Rastafarianism. We learn that his mom was a cop and how she told him not to go out certain times because, you know, when the elections were happening, because she didn't want him to be killed. And we learn about Pan-Africanism and what an influence that had. And it's just this whole society and culture opens up within the interview. And it's really quite phenomenal.
Well, it's because it's in some ways it's all there in the book, but I always assume that the listener hasn't read the book. Often they haven't because the book is new, or they just haven't anyway. So if the two avenues of opening up the book to the listener is through the author's life, which is the sort of shrink manquer part, because everyone can relate to parents, family, upbringing, expectations, whatever. And the other part is the context of the book, the ideas that are in the book. So that and especially that in that case of Marlon James, it was a world that I didn't know that well. So I thought this is an opportunity, like for me and the listener, you know, to find out more. And he was really good. I mean, he was very forthcoming.
And it happens in the Margareta Fontrada interview
as
well.
Yeah, she was wonderful.
When she's talking about her childhood in Berlin, which was in the late 40s and early 50s, and her English is very fluent, but it's not entirely exact. And at one point she said something that I don't think I'll ever forget, and I don't think it's what she actually meant to say, but she said, "My city was destruction." And it just, you know, suddenly I was thinking about, yeah, Anselm Kiefer, who deals with the same period, and Zabold, who is also interviewed in your book.
Mm-hmm.
To have all this insight into writers and the way they are, I mean, they're a very tricky subject, right? Is there a typical writer? Is there a certain kind of trait that is universal to writers?
No. First of all, there's certainly no typical writer. And in the introduction to one of my earlier books, I talked about how what keeps me interested is how different writers are. You know, and as I was saying earlier about the 25 years, it's not that writers are, you know, as unique as snowflakes. You know, each one different. But there is no typical writer, and in a sense, it's tricky, and in a sense, it's not, because writers, because they work in words and ideas, are obviously, in some ways, the easiest, most accessible people to interview.
Even though so many writers are introverts?
Well, they are and they aren't. They are and they aren't.
If they're talking about themselves, maybe not so much.
Yeah.
Have you yourself ever written fiction, or?
No.
And no interest?
No, I think if anything, it probably gives me an advantage to not. I'm just so admirative of the whole enterprise of creating of that creation. I've written nonfiction. I've done journalism, and I've written little sort of, you know, semi memoirish things. But I've never written any fiction. No.
Are you going to write your memoirs?
No, that's this is it.
This is it. kind of beside behind are, the scenes at Writers and Company?
There's not. No, I don't think there's enough. I mean, it's interesting. After I was so pleased that Biblioasis wanted to publish this selection of interviews, because it seemed that there was the publishers seemed interested in gossip, and they were interested. I was approached some years ago if I would write exactly that sort of behind the scenes and what happened to this one and that one and the stories behind things. And they weren't interested in the ideas and the substance of what the conversations were about. So I'm grateful to Biblioasis for their interest in bringing this book out, because to me it's much more substantial than my anecdotes. I mean, and I've included a few of them anyway in the intro.
Yeah, I mean, your intros to each writer and your intro to the book provides some of that. But if you had to choose between a mediocre writer who was really forthcoming and garrulous, and a brilliant writer who was
easy peasy. The brilliant one.
Yeah. Okay. That's what I thought. But
I have him do a really long reading.
That's very good. I'm going to make you read soon. We're building up to that. Okay. If you had the possibility of interviewing three dead writers. From any period
at a dinner party at the same time.
What would your list be?
Oh, that's hard. I used to say, like, there's a character in the Carol Shields novel Swan that who said she'd like to interview Virginia Woolf. So I used to say, in answer to a question like that, it's true, I haven't really been interviewed that often, but I do give talks and appear at festivals sometimes, and there'll be audience Q&A, and that question might come up now and then. So I used to say something like Virginia Woolf, except she was such a snob, I don't think she would be, she would be in the genius not want to talk to me category. and then everybody says Shakespeare, but... I know.
Where would you start with Shakespeare? Yeah,
his life. Who's we don't know. There's so much we don't know about him. So
love the sonnets.
Yeah, that's right. And who were they written to exactly? So that's two.
No, that's not. That's not even two.
It's not even two.
You didn't want to do either of those.
Yeah. No, I do want to do Shakespeare.
I
really would.
Okay.
I really would like to interview Shakespeare. That's hard.
I'll let you off if you don't want to do it. Okay. What are the three best interviews you've ever done?
Oh, maybe I'll do the writers I'd like to interview who are dead.
Let's take a step back.
That's easier. No, I have trouble with that. I mean, sometimes you ask authors what are their favorite books, and they say, oh, I can't say they're like children. And I can hardly say that these hundreds of authors are like children. but these interviews, I mean, I picked 15 for this book, which they're obviously among my favorites. But I probably could have picked another 15. I mean, there's such riches over the two decades and a half to choose from. I couldn't. It'd be very hard to choose favorite interviews. There's some that stand out in my mind. I remember the first time I interviewed Oliver Sacks. He was just one of the most lovable people, and I'd been wanting to interview him for years. And he didn't have a particularly new book out, but I've been reading all his pieces in the New Yorker, the ones that became an anthropologist on Mars. Right. And it just was something outstanding. But there are too many. It's hard to say. Favorites.
It's not a fair question.
No.
It'd be like even saying the three best interviews from this book. I couldn't tell you, because they're all so enthralling. It's pretty amazing. Do you ever read for pleasure?
Mm-hmm.
What do you read?
Often fiction.
Yeah. When do you have time?
When do I have time? That's a very good question. On holidays. Holidays are the only, in the summer is the only time I get a chance to read dead authors, or in this past summer, Elena Ferrante.
Okay.
Who is a living author, but writes, she's obviously, well, first of all, we don't know who she is, and second of all, she doesn't speak English, so she's not. It's not for work.
So, so you went through all the.
I read the well in the summer. I read the first three of what are called the Neapolitan novels, and then Neapolitan novels, and then the fourth one was hadn't been translated yet in the summer. So I read it over the Christmas holidays. But it was a real pleasure, such an indulgence, to go through volume one and finish it and put it down and pick up the next one and just keep reading. So I really feel like I'm on holiday if I read a novel for pleasure. Although there's sometimes I find myself reaching for a Post-it. And I have to, you know, like, no.
Do you ever read, I don't know, just a regular trashy novel?
No, and it's not. It's not out of snobbery. I'm ridiculously, relatively a slow reader, and there's only so much time, and I'm reading so much for work
anyway. You're a slow reader? Did you say that?
I have said that. I mean, I don't move my lips. I'm not that slow, but relatively slow. And there's all these books I'm reading for work, and so when I have time to read, I mean, there's always things I'm saving up. You know, not just dead authors or Elena Ferrante, but other things I like to read. I'll read The New Yorker, I'll read, you know, magazines, literary magazines, I like that kind of stuff. But no, I there's no time to read trash. I mean, just because I really don't have time.
And I know whenever we've talked about books that, you know, say I'd read it and I thought you'd like, you always say, keep it short. I want short books.
Oh, I know, you like 900, you recommended 2 900-page books to me.
Sorry.
Well, maybe next summer.
Okay, but I still would recommend those two books.
Okay.
Yeah, they're worth it. They one of them took me six months.
Tell everyone.
One's I have forgotten his name. It's a Cuban writer in exile, and the book's called "The Man Who Loved Dogs," and it's about Trotsky, but it covers 50 years and all kinds of different points of view, from Trotsky himself to his killer to it just gives you the whole failure of the utopian dream. It personalizes it, and by the end you feel like you've read a great Russian novel. It's just an extraordinary book. And the other is a Japanese book. Is that the one?
No, it was the other one. It was by the son of Gordon Lish.
Oh yeah, what was that called? I've forgotten. You know, I recommended that and then I didn't finish it.
Oh. Well, I'm so glad I found that out in time. What's the Japanese one?
The Japanese one is, and I've forgotten her name. I see this is yeah. What we talked about last night, how
we're going to spend the whole time saying, remember what's
his name? Who was that writer? It's a book called A True Novel. And the writer is, I think she teaches at Yale. And it's Wuthering Heights retold in post-war Japan.
Oh, does she speak English?
Yes, she does.
Oh,
well, she teaches it right. At Yale or maybe Princeton. I can't remember, one of those places.
Well, Mary Stinson is here, my producer, so she's making notes right
okay.
now.
Yeah, because it's the most amazing novel because it's told in the kind of flattest way, and you're going along and you're going along and you're thinking, well, nothing's happening here, and then it's. They don't talk a lot about social class in Japan, but the whole book's premise is the destructiveness of social class in Japan, especially as the aristocracy was breaking down after the war and the middle class was coming up and everything. But it really is Wuthering Heights, and it has that kind of impact if you can make it through 900. I think it may even be 1,000 pages. Yeah.
Did you read Murakami? What's it called? 11...
Oh, IQ?
IQ, yeah.
Yeah, no.
Is anyone in the room?
I mean, I tried.
That?
Yeah, did anybody make it through the two volumes of Murakami's
novel? IQ. 84. Thank you. Yeah. IQ 84.
I think I got about 400 pages in and just couldn't do it.
And you're a Japanophile.
Totally. Yeah. But I think what happens to some writers when they reach that kind of level of fame is that
nobody
ever says you should cut 40% and so they get to do anything. And I think it's not really to his benefit. But I mean, the book sold anyway because
it's him.
He's in every airport in the world. I resent that. Alice Munro said that she lied to you.
Where did she say that?
In the interview, she said, "You've known me for a long time, and you know I lie."
But
and that just really, because the interview with Alice Munro is, I think it's the most distinctive in the book because it doesn't feel literary. It feels like you're sitting in the...
in the cafe. Well, yeah. That's very astute of you because it was done in this restaurant, and it was done, that's where she often meets people. In the restaurant in the town near where she lives in southern Ontario and southwest Ontario. But it was done for, she's a hard person to get to interview, and the occasion there was she was nominated for, she was shortlisted for the Giller Prize, which I believe she won for the second time in 2004 for Runaway. And CBC Television was producing it, and in those days they would run a short film at the Giller Awards, and for the televised version of the Gillers, right. They'd have these little like three to five minute little mini documentaries, and they used that, so they wanted somebody to interview her, and they drew on that interview for the documentary. It wasn't exactly the usual circumstances in which it was sort of more of a free ranging conversation than a strictly this book, that book kind of thing.
But then all of a sudden she just drops that, you know.
Well, I don't know. See, I assume everyone's telling the truth until proven otherwise.
With writers, you do that? After 25 years? Maybe that's the secret.
Maybe that's the secret.
I thought one of the unexpected sort of pleasures of the book was all the advice on writing, because so much of what's out there is just so awful. You know, there are those lists of 10 things you should never do in a novel, and I just want to, you know, throw the book across the room. In fact, I do. But then I came across Philip Roth. You don't interview him, but you mention him mm-hmm. in the introduction, and he said, "You're always an amateur when you begin a new book."
Yeah. So and many writers have said that.
That was really consoling, you know?
They say it doesn't get any easier.
Yeah.
And
because I thought it was just me.
No. Almost every writer has said that. The other thing you're asking earlier about if there's anything that writers have in common, and there's no one thing, and there's no typical writer, but the thing that writers have talked about more than any other thing about themselves, insofar as I'm willing to generalize, is that they see themselves as outsiders.
Yeah.
So whether they're literally outsiders because they're in exile or immigrants or whatever, or just they've lived in the same town all their lives and they just feel like emotionally or respectfully, so that's the thing that, if there is a theme or a trope that writers bring up, it's that they feel they're outsiders.
Yeah, I think Alexander Aymon said that he had always considered himself an outsider even when he was still living in Sarajevo, and then he came to the United States and was even more of an outsider, and how he kind of delighted in that. And then he started writing in English.
Yeah.
He says that funny thing. He said, Nabokov made love to the English language, but I'll settle for heavy petting. And the other liar, and this was much more elaborate, was Orhan Pamuk, the great Turkish writer and Nobel Prize. But there are actually six Nobel.
Yeah, there are six Nobel Prize winners in the book. And I just heard Orhan Pamuk is a finalist for the International Man Booker.
Yes, I saw that. And so is...
Elena Ferrante.
Yes. That's a horse race. But you're discussing... I guess it must have been...
My Name is Red, or
My Name is Red,
Museum
yes.
of Innocence.
Yeah, and you're very earnestly kind of talking to him about all the theory about Ottoman miniaturist painting, right. and you're really trying to get to, you know, how he did his research, and then
it's like the Marlon James thing where I'm trying to find out all kinds of historical right. accuracy, the context, and
in the middle of the interview he said, "Oh, I made all that up."
It's true.
I remember when I read that book, I was just
convinced.
Sure
Were
that
you
was
convinced he knew everything?
Boy, did he do his research.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Edward P. Jones did the same thing. He wrote an amazing novel that won lots of prizes. He's an Afro-American writer from Washington, D.C. And he wrote about 19th century slave owners, including a black slave owner, and all kinds of details of everything. And it took him years and years to write the book, and he was working as a civil servant, and he said he carried it all in his head and everything. And I said, what, all that research? And he said, I made it all up.
Every bit of it.
Jim Crace, you're right, they're all lied to me. Jim Crace, well, in fact, no, they told the truth. They didn't lie. They lied elsewhere. They told me the truth. Jim Crace wrote a book in which he describes some dead bodies that are found and what happens to sort of the putrefaction process of what happens in minute detail. And I said, you spent all that time doing the research on that? And he said, no, he made it up.
He made it up. Good for him.
Who really hoodwinked me was Ian McEwan in Enduring Love. This is a theme I've never thought of before. You've tapped this whole... Ian McEwan, in a book called Enduring Love, he made up an entire syndrome of obsession. And at the end of the book, he has various letters and research documents and everything. And I thought it was all real. And throughout the interview, I thought it was real. I only found out afterwards.
Did he tell you, or
no?
No, you found out.
No, that was, I was completely duped on that one.
I think also the most moving interview for me in the book was Zabold, who you call Max because you.
He
you
calls
know.
Himself. Yeah. I never think of calling him Max. W.G. Zabold.
And he had two things that he said, and I meant to ask you to look these over so they wouldn't be like a cold read for you.
Oh, okay.
But it's just two paragraphs. The first is about writing as self-deception. I have them here.
Okay.
And the second is about writing as a behavioral problem.
Okay.
Which is okay. Dear to my heart.
Excuse me. Writing a self-deception. So there is, of course, a degree of self-deception at work when you're looking at the past, even if you redesign it in terms of tragedy, because tragedy is still a pattern of order and an attempt to give meaning to something, to a life or a series of lives. It's still as if it were a positive way of looking at things, whereas in fact it might just as well have been one damn thing after another with no sense to it at all. And Zabold sees writing as a behavioral problem. He questions the very nature of writing, quote, "It's a received wisdom that it's good to talk about traumas, but it's not always true, especially if you are the instigator of making people remember, talk about their past and so on. You are not certain whether your intrusion into somebody's life may not cause a certain degree of collateral damage, which that person might otherwise have been spared. So there's an ethical problem there. And then the whole business of writing, of course. You make things up. You smooth certain contradictory elements that you come across. The whole thing is fraught with vanity, with motives that you really don't understand yourself."
Thank you. This has been a huge pleasure for me. And I think we have to go to Q&A here because I know lots of people have lots of questions.
Okay.
Maybe this is where we'll get into the deep secrets of your private life. Are there questions? Yes, yes. We have a microphone. There's someone right here in the red jacket.
Yeah, thanks. Nice readings. I like those paragraphs.
Wanted to cut someone off from talking too much? And if so, how do you do it?
Did everyone hear the question?
Yeah.
During an interview, do you have the desire or the impulse to cut someone off for talking too much? And if so, how do you do it? I'm very fortunate because my interviews aren't live. I used to host an arts magazine show called The Arts Tonight, which often was live, and then you did have to talk to time. But because my shows aren't live, it's extremely rare that I would need to cut someone off. It would only be if I knew I had a very limited amount of time and that they were going to bolt or we were going to lose the line or the connection to the studio in the other place. And So when it's face to face, it's much easier. You don't even have to say anything, you just look down. And they'll soon stop talking. But if it's not face to face, then you do have to interrupt. And sometimes just an intake of breath, if they hear that, they'll know you're trying to get in and they might stop, but they might not. But then the other thing you have to do is, if you have interrupted them, because it's going to be edited out, that interruption will be edited out because they stop mid-sentence, and or the reason you're interrupting them is because you know you don't want to use that part of what they're saying, then you have to stop, take a breath, as if it's a new, you know, it's a fresh question, so that the producer can make a clean edit.
And your book, incidentally, is dedicated to your two
producers.
Editors, Mary Stinson, who's here tonight.
Somewhere.
Where is Mary?
There.
Ah, there. And Sandra Rabinovich.
Yeah. Sandra's not here tonight. She's in Toronto.
Okay. No, I was looking for another question.
Oh.
I, like J.M. Coetzee, have to write my questions down. We're peers in that respect. How do you wind down it's a corollary to the previous question. How do you wind down a beautiful interview? What happens after we stop listening?
Well, usually the interview hasn't gone on much longer than that. I mean, there's some editing and so on. And sometimes in the course of an interview, I'll hear an ending. I'll hear that this a wrap, as we would call it. So that's the end. I don't wind down, especially if it's gone well. I mean, it really is exhilarating. So I don't seek to wind down, you know. I don't want to. It's just, and especially if you know, we're in the studio and, you know, we go with the producer afterwards, just walking back to the office, we're just really happy and we'll talk about what they said or something like that. So there's no winding down. It's more the moping when it hasn't gone so well. And you're thinking, can we cut this out? Can we cut that out? If there are enough readings to make up for all the hesitations or, you know, things like that. You just don't know how people are going to talk.
Thank you. Hi. So I was hoping you'd be interviewing yourself.
Thanks a lot.
You know, I always like when you talk about and you sort of say, and so how did you feel when your father left you? You know, like you ask these intimate questions from these authors who to me are amazing people, because I really have a lot of respect for authors and because I find them so thoughtful. I love listening to your interviews because they're such thoughtful people. Mm-hmm. So when you ask them a question, it's not like a yes or no answer. They go on and they tell you all this stuff. And so I keep thinking over the years, I've listened to you interview people who write fiction, of course, and then you write this, like, the top seller who wrote about the Greek economy, and then about what's happening in Russia, and then, I don't know, like, the Slavic countries. You must be a genius by now.
No.
You've had so many different people talk in depth about so many things. I can't believe you're a slow reader. Like, in a week? Like, so it's really not so much a question, but just an observation. I'm just thinking that you have been privileged to hear from some of the smartest people talk about some of the most interesting things going on. It's not like CBC, oh, callers, call us and tell you what you feel about that metro incident. Like, we're hearing people who know what they're talking about, important issues, and I just think it's fantastic. So it's really not a question. It's just, I don't know if you want to answer that, but it's really amazing.
Well, thank you. Yes. Well, I don't. I've compared it to like cramming before an exam. I mean, it really feels that way. I know everything at that moment, and then it's all gone. You know, or most of it. I like to think there's a little residue of something left, but not a lot. But at that moment, I know. I mean, there are some instances that are quite comical where I sort of know more than the person. I mean, about their own lives. Because I remember, like, Frank McCourt mentioned he was doing something, and I said, well, actually, you went to that place afterwards. And he said, you're right. and it was actually one of my favorite all-time moments. You're talking about favorite interviews. This would be one of my favorite all-time moments I hadn't thought about recently. It took place at Blue Met, and it was some of you might have been there. It was when I interviewed Margaret Drabble and Michael Holroyd together. And it was, and they were just both so articulate and so charming. And they both had books that were either was that were autobiographical. His was a memoir. Hers was fiction, but it was autobiographical. It was about her mother. And they had unusually they had lived. They got married, and then they remained living apart for a number of years after they got married. Partly because Holroyd was still working on a multi-volume biography of George Bernard Shaw, and he said, you know, Shaw was still in his house taking so much room that the, you know,
no room for Margaret.
No room for Margaret, and she was working on the Oxford Companion to English Literature. So she her place, was, and I think she had maybe she even had some kids still living there. Anyway, it took them a while to get back to actually move in together. And so it was here, and I asked them about that, and I said, you know, it took you, I don't know, 9 years, 11 years, 7, I can't remember the exact number now, see, it's all gone, but at that point I knew it, and I said, it took you X number of years before you moved in together, and Michael Holroyd said, that long? And then he said, well, you would know.
It's true.
But in terms of asking those intimate questions, like how did you feel when your you know parents broke up, it's always, I think just about always drawn. I try in any case to respect privacy in the sense that it's been alluded to in their writing, or that it somehow comes out of their work, or it's mentioned, or it's tangential, or something. I try not to just sort of jump in with.
Well, they do seem to enjoy, you know, most authors jump right in and they talk a lot about that, which is so enjoyable. Thank you. May I say something as editor here, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but because Eleanor will probably not say this, but what you don't hear on the radio is that almost after almost every interview, the guest will say to Eleanor, that is wonderful. I've never had a conversation like that. Thank you for taking the time.
Oh, I love them. That's easy.
Succinct.
I'm sorry, Elena Ferrante, the Italian writer.
I'd like to ask you.
And it was
about
funny. Sorry, I'll just add a little end note to that. Was when we had the Writers and Company had its 25th anniversary. So I still have to look this way because the mic's there, but I'm talking to you. At its 25th anniversary event at the International Festival of Authors in Toronto last fall, and there was a panel with Zadie Smith and Alexander Himon, both of whom are in the book, and Carol Phillips. And we at the last question I asked, what book have you really enjoyed or has meant a lot to you? Both Zadie Smith and Alexander Himon mentioned the Elena Ferrante books. So that was interesting.
So may I ask for your sense of the state of world literature? You read so much. Are you optimistic, or is it healthy?
I'm terrible at generalizations, but I enjoy a lot of the books that I read. So it seems to me that there's so much out there, and I certainly can't speak for world literature. I only read what's in translation. Even when I go to these countries, I'm still constrained by people who, I can only talk to people who speak English because it's for English radio, so I wouldn't presume to comment on world literature, but I like what I see.
I think we have time for one more question. Yes.
Is there a writer that you're dying to interview?
I had a big wish list, and I have fortunately been able to speak to many of them. I mean, like Philip Roth or Joan Didion, or I would love to talk to Elena Ferrante if I could, but not by email, you know, which is the only kind of interviews she seems to be giving right now. Just to come back to that, so I'm not sure. I have to come up with a new wish list.
I think that's a good place to stop. I think we should mention again that your book is available upstairs. At the Drawn and Quarterly Library and at a 10% discount tonight only.
And I'll be signing books, and authors' royalties go to Penn.
Thank you so much, Eleanor.